Yes. Okay, so week three, social theory of law. And this week I want to conclude the discussion on natural law theory and to talk about its criticisms, especially from the sociological tradition. Okay? And one of the things that I highlighted last week is that natural law theory derives, you might say, its motivation from a certain kind of idea about humanity's relationship to God. God understood as a lawgiver, and so in a sense, God does at a sort of the ultimate level what human beings are also empowered to do, which is to say to give order. So just as God gives order to nature through the laws of nature, human beings can give order to their societies through laws as well. And so then the question becomes, what is the relationship between the divine law and the human law? And natural law theory is basically about how those two things connect. And so this is, as I was pointing out last week, against the context of the so-called Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which has this kind of conception of God that's relevant for natural law theory. Because as I mentioned last week, if you look at the Greeks, for example, in terms of their ideas of natural order and so forth, they don't think about nature as being law-like, right? So that the Greek word for nature, phusis, is understood as something that has a kind of will, power, mind of its own, but isn't necessarily rational, right? It isn't necessarily law-like. It's just there. It does its thing. It's like fate, right? This is the way it's understood in Greek. And so the contrasting term, right, nomos, which is the Greek word for law in the sense of laws that you make, conventional law, right, is seen as something radically different from phusis. It isn't, as it were, because in natural law theory, what human beings do when they govern society is like a microcosm of what God does when he's governing the universe. But there isn't that kind of micro-macro relationship in the Greek tradition. It's rather, there's this nature which has an independent reality, and then there's our attempt to give some kind of order to it, which is what nomos does, which is what conventional law does. Okay? So natural law theory presumes that there is this kind of law-like character to not only the human realm, but to nature as well, and that all of this can be codified, right? And the reason why, when you study jurisprudence or any kind of legal theory, you start with natural law theory is because this is the account of law that rests on codification, right? And sort of imagines that, at least in principle, everything can be covered under law. Okay, now, of course, what happens is, as Europe becomes secularized in the modern period, which is to say that religious authority no longer counts as the ultimate form of governing, right, then natural law theory starts to lose its force. And of course, the first way that happened was with the Protestant Reformation, when there was no longer a unified Christendom, right? When people, as it were, derived authority from other sources, even religious sources, but other than the Pope, right? So the fact, if you look at the way Europe starts to form into nation states in the early modern period, right, typically what happens is it's a story of various monarchs and princes moving away from the Church of Rome and establishing their own churches in the first instance. And so you think about the Church of England, for example, when Henry VIII splits from the Church of Rome, right? You get the Church of England, and this is something that happens throughout the rest of Europe as well, except, of course, for Central Europe, which remains for quite a long time into the 19th century, the Holy Roman Empire, right? And this is where you have Austria and Italy and all these places very much still under the control of the Church until the 19th century. But otherwise, you get this kind of secularization taking place. So there's a question that starts to arise very much in the period of the 16th and 17th centuries about what is the basis for law if it is no longer religious authority, and or at least no longer a kind of unified sense of religious authority in the sense that natural law theory had promised. This is not to say natural law theory disappears overnight. By no means. Natural law theory, as I pointed out last time, continues to get invoked even in the modern period as the source of an idea of a higher law, right? So in other words, a sort of law against which laws are judged. So when we talk about whether laws are fair, whether laws are just, right, there's an implicit notion to natural law there, even though that's no longer so clearly tied to a sort of theological conception of God as an authority behind the natural law. Okay? But the point is that natural law still manages to stick around for quite a while, and of course, arguably, even in our own time, natural law theory is in the background of a lot of our thinking about human rights, let's say, about the dignity of the human being. Okay? And I will talk later on in the module about the notion of human rights, because we're, you know, human rights aren't the only rights on the block these days. We've got animal rights, and pretty soon we'll have android rights. And so what's at stake with all these rights will be an interesting question. And of course, as you probably know, human rights in under the name really only gets any kind of legal enforcement at an international level with the UN Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. This is not to say nobody ever used the term human rights. Of course they did. But the idea of there being some kind of international legal enforcement of such a thing, where you can actually, as it were, take countries to court over these matters, is something that really only begins in 1948. Okay? It's, in other words, it becomes something more than just a philosophical notion. It becomes something legally enforceable, at least in principle. 1948. So the question is, you know, why did it take so long? What was going on there? We will look at this later on, okay? But I don't want to get to that point right now, but that's kind of where you might say natural law kind of evolves. It evolves into, in the modern era, this conception of human rights, right, which are, as it were, principles that need to be upheld for all of human beings, regardless of the differences of the legal systems under which they normally live. Okay? And here I'll just put a name on the table for those of you who are interested in following this up now, that the person who designed the modern idea of human rights in the UN Charter of 1948 was in fact a natural law theorist by the name of Jacques Maritain, a Frenchman, who was a kind of latter day 20th century follower of Thomas Aquinas. Okay? So he's a kind of Catholic modernist. And he's the one, if you look at the history of where the wording comes from and everything, you will see it goes back to this guy, okay? And Maritain is someone who, in a sense, really does try to bring the natural law tradition up to date and making it relevant even to secular law, okay? So by no means do I want to say natural law theory has disappeared. It is very much with us, but it is not there as the front order, first order law that it was, let's say, during the Middle Ages or even in the early modern period. Okay, now the sociological tradition, I mentioned this in the first week. Sociology as a discipline largely arose from considerations of what it means to become modern, modernization. And modernization, in the first instance, has to do with the nature of legitimacy. That is to say, on what grounds do laws have authority, right? And so this question of legitimation is one that, let's say, Max Weber, I suppose, in the sociological tradition is most closely associated with. And so, but he's not the only one who thinks about these matters. In fact, this is kind of a common thing. On what basis do the laws have force? Because if you go back to natural law theory, generally speaking, the answer would be, well, the king says so, and the king has the direct pipeline to God. And so it was very common, until we get into the secular period, to believe in something called the divine right of kings. That in some sense, the kings are connected to God. Now, one may have a kind of elaborate mythology about this, Or one might just have the idea that the Pope or some relevant theological authority says this king's legitimate and therefore you should obey him. Okay? But of course, this is in the modern period, we move away from this kind of idea. And so here we also start to move away in terms of conceptions of the legitimacy of the law. All right? And Weber makes a very interesting distinction, which is relevant here, and that is between a substantive and a procedural basis for underwriting the law. Okay? And what he wants to argue is that basically what you see in the modern period, right, is a move from the substantive to the procedural. Now, what does this mean to have a substantive basis for legitimation or substantive basis for the law? It's kind of like what I just described to you, namely that you follow the law because the law came from the right place, from the right sort of person who in some way has been anointed, right? And so this person is regarded as having some kind of holy authority, perhaps, being wise, being all-powerful, right? In other words, there's substantive properties of the lawgiver that provide the ground for you following the law. It isn't really what the law itself says, it's where the law is coming from, who's saying it. Right? So it matters that the king says it. Okay? And that's substantive because it relies on the people enforcing the law in a very direct way. Okay? On the other hand, a procedural basis for grounding the law is where the law is basically the law on the books, and it's what the law says. And the law is understood in a somewhat depersonalized form. Right? So the law is something that, in a sense, in principle, applies to everyone and can be enforced by anyone. Right? The laws have a kind of objectivity to them. Right? And so the point is, whether you follow the laws, which is to say the letter of the law, whether you follow the procedure, not who in fact is doing it. Right? Now, the move from substantive to procedural as a basis for underwriting the law is, if you think about it, very closely tied to the idea, to ideas of democratization. Right? Everyone is equally covered under the law. Everyone is equally subject to the law. This is procedural, right? It's like the law is like rules of the game. It covers everyone, okay? It's not like we have, you know, one group of people do one thing and another group of people do something else, because that would be substantive. But rather, everyone's covered under the same rules, okay? Now, this is a really radical idea. Now, of course, we take this for granted today. When you study law, right, the idea is that everyone's equally covered under the law, and so as a result, we want to design our laws so that they're actually fair to everybody. This is quite a normal way of thinking about how you do legislation. However, this is an idea that had to be invented, okay? And I think a good way to see how this idea had to be invented is if you recall in the previous week, one of the things that I said in discussing natural law theory was that natural law theory got a lot of its intuitive appeal by piggybacking under the default ways in which society was organized, right? And what does that mean? That means, and to put it in the old Latin, right, the lex gentium, right? In other words, the fundamental units of society and governance were the family. Right? Your identity, remember I mentioned this last week, that your identity is tied to how you were born, where you were born, who your parents were. And as it were, that heredity, right, birth, pretty much determined your default position throughout life. And in this respect, there was a kind of natural order to things that was partly biological and partly legal. And this is one of the things that made it difficult for people to become something other than what they were born into. And as I mentioned last week, you might say one of the things about the modern period is that it breaks apart the lex gentium. In other words, people are no longer bound by the identities of their birth. Right? They can achieve identities through their own interactions, by engaging in free contracts with other people, by getting jobs of various sorts that in many cases will take them far away from their origins. Okay? But if you go back to natural law and you look at the way natural law operated in the Middle Ages and the early modern period, what you see is this lex gentium, which is a very substantive notion of the law, because basically it says you got different laws for different people, depending on how you were born. So if you were born as a serf, there are laws governing you and how Lord and the masters can take care, deal with you. And if you're born as a noble, there are different laws that apply to you by the way you were born. Okay? So it's not that everyone's covered under the same laws, but rather the laws are relative to your standing in the society, which is determined largely by biology. Okay? This changes in the modern period. Not overnight again, but it does change gradually so that you get a more procedural notion of the law, a law in which that applies to everyone and in which everyone is covered equally. Okay? And so when one talks about the universal character of the law, this is what they mean. They mean the idea that it's the same laws for everyone. Okay? And this is very closely tied to the idea of people relating to each other at the fundamental level as citizens. Right? In other words, they do not, you know, in natural law theory, you would be relating to someone in terms of your class position, basically. So if you're a serf, you relate to the noble as an inferior. Okay? There is no notion of citizenship as such in natural law theory. What there is that everyone's got their place in the society, and it's in virtue of the specific place that they fill in the society, that's how their legal standing is determined. But in the modern world, okay, you relate to other people by virtue of common citizenship. And the common citizenship means that you're all equally covered under the same laws. And this is why citizenship is such a big deal, actually, right? Because if you're not a citizen of a country, right, then it's a kind of open question how you get dealt with. Right? And we know this today, of course. And as people migrate from one country to another and their standing with respect to different countries is very uncertain, then it's a real open question what happens to them, even today. So this idea of there being universal coverage under the law presupposes that people relate to each other in the standing of citizens. But again, this is a modern idea. This is not an idea that existed throughout history. Okay? So that even when you go to ancient Athens, right, which was a big, you know, or the Roman Republic for that matter, right, these were two places where there was a clear notion of citizenship. But the people who were eligible for citizenship was a relatively small percentage of the actual population. In both cases, maybe 10% were citizens, and as a result, amongst them, there was equality under the law. But not among all the human beings living in the society. Okay? So this idea of universal coverage for citizenship is a very modern idea, a very hard-fought idea. But it is a very distinctive idea, and the founders of sociology reflected on this. Okay? Now, one of the interesting things that arises under these circumstances is thinking about, and again, what is gained and what is lost by this. Okay? Now, I think it is fair to say, the way sociologists think about this question, about what is involved in the transition, because so far I've been talking about this transition from, let's say, the substantive kind of law of natural law theory to the sort of more procedural law that we see in the modern period. I've been talking about this pretty much in terms of the differences that it makes from a legal standpoint, in terms of the character of the laws, people's coverage under the laws, right? In other words, very much in that mode. But of course, we can ask a further question, which is maybe a more strictly sociological question, which is about what does this mean culturally? What's the difference? What's the difference to live in one kind of system versus another kind of system? Okay? And this is something that sociologists in the classical period, the period I asked you to read the part of Cernillo's book about, they were very concerned about this because I think all of these guys, whether we're talking about Marx or Durkheim or Weber or a couple of the other people who are very prominent in this discussion, I'm going to talk about this guy, Ternes, is that there are losses and there are gains with regard to what happens in this transition from natural law to the more modern conception of law. And here I want to draw your attention to a distinction in German that Tierney's coined, which is still used a fair bit in sociology, Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft. Okay? Now, Gemeinschaft is basically the kind of social relations that are based on the community, on the family, right, and which natural law theory generally underwrote, right? It operates on the assumption that, in a sense, the family is the most natural form of social life, and that you might say the kinds of laws that are in the books and civil codes and things like this, that those laws are in some sense artificial. Okay? In other words, the natural bonds that people have for each other by virtue of family relations are in fact the basis of whatever, connections we have to each other in society. So in a sense, it's like connections of feeling, right? And so when one talks about Gemeinschaft, one talks about social relations that are promoted largely on the basis of face-to-face interactions, from relations of trust, from people knowing each other for a long time, living together in the same places, having to face the same sorts of problems and situations. And that, in a sense, natural law theory rationalized that kind of state of affairs. Okay? And of course, what this particular Gemeinschaft culture has going for it, you might say, is that you've got a sense of belonging, right? You've got a sense of being part of something. Even, your identity is stable, right? It may be stable because your identity is basically the identity you were born with and you can't do anything about it. But nevertheless, that does provide a certain amount of stability, and it provides a certain sense of expectations about how you would presume the world to work around you. There's a sense of normal. This is not trivial. This is not a trivial point. Okay? The implication of the word, the connotations of the term Gemeinschaft, Gemeinschaftlich, is kind of like empathy and feeling that you have to other people. This kind of thing. Okay? Now, Gesellschaft is totally different. Okay? And that's the procedure, that's the culture that follows procedural law. And that is the culture where remember, as I pointed out last week, that the primary form of human interaction that you get in the modern period through the proceduralization of the law is the contract. Right? The contract. And so, as you see, when natural law theory starts to get modernized, you start to get social contract theory, right, as a way of understanding this. But the contract, now contracts are very interesting objects, you might say, in the law. And of course, contracts have always existed. However, the idea of basically treating the whole legal system as a bunch of elaborated contracts, starting from the Constitution of the country, which is a kind of enormous social contract, right, to then all the other contracts that people make for the various aspects of their lives, that's a very radical modernizing move, okay? What it requires, in order to have the freedom to make contracts in this kind of way that we presume of a liberal society, right, people have to have pretty fluid identities, right? In other words, your personhood, right, your standing as a legal agent has to be relatively abstract, right? In other words, if you're expecting that people are going to have to engage in a wide range of voluntary associations in order to get through life, because there is no presumptive expectation, right? So in other words, if I want food, I no longer can rely on the serf to do it. I've got to go to a shop and buy it. That's a contract relation I have to enter into with a complete stranger behind the counter, buying stuff I don't even know where it comes from. Okay? And you just think about it. All the things that are part of modern life which involve contract relations, where you're basically operating as an abstract individual in very specific circumstances. Right? So the guy who sells the loaf of bread to you, he couldn't care less about anything about you as long as you've got the money. At least he shouldn't, right? I mean, in a sense, our law privileges anonymity. Right? If the guy didn't want to sell you a loaf of bread because he didn't like the look of you, that would be a legal problem. Right? So in a sense, in order for all these contract relations to work in modern society, right, you should have no interest in the person you're dealing with. You should just be concerned about whether they can uphold their end of the contract, which usually involves money. Okay? That's the modern world. And that's how we construct all of social life. So a lot of stuff that in the past would have been done for us or would have happened, you know, through some kind of established relations over generations, you know, through heredity and all this kind of stuff, now has to be manufactured, in a sense, moment by moment. So again, think about it. Where you get your food from? In the past, you grew it. And you knew where you grew it. It was on your farm. Okay? And depending on whether you owned the farm or you were a serf, you had a different relationship to it, but you knew where the food was coming from. And it was only when you had, you know, too much or too little growing that you actually had to go to a market and get something. Otherwise, you just did the stuff yourself. It was very reliable, very dependable, didn't involve any contract relations. Nowadays, of course, we go to different places to get food, depending on where we are, what time of the day, what we feel like eating, right? And so you can end up buying food over the course of a year from what, 100 different vendors maybe or more? That's pretty interesting, isn't it? And all those people who sell you all this food, they couldn't care less what you do with it, right? At least they're not supposed to care what you do with it. They couldn't care less even if you die from it, right? I mean, so the thing here is, this is a very interesting kind of world that we live in from that standpoint. Because what enables this kind of freedom that we associate with the procedural view of the law is a kind of abstractness of the person, right? That people are dealing with each other as abstract individuals under very specific circumstances defined by the contract relation. And this is where money, right, money is a big deal. Because money is kind of the marker of this. Right, you can kind of tell whether a contract is being respected or not by how the money's moving. Right? Did I pay for this bread? Okay, that's a good deal. Right? The money went the right way. It didn't stay in my pocket, and you got exactly the amount of money I agreed to give you. Okay? And if you look at the way money flows, right, you could see whether the contracts are being upheld or not. And again, this is very interesting, right? Because money is the ultimate abstract form of social relation, right? Because money is the kind of thing you can just about buy anything with, right? Anything of social relevance has a price on it. And you can trade it, too. So this business about money is quite, you know, if you've read that part 3 of the Chernilla book, you'll see that there's a lot of emphasis placed on the increasing legal importance of money in the modern era. And in a way, that's the symbol of the abstractness of the way our social life works. Okay? Where in a sense, one of the reasons, you know, one, we don't care where you come from. We don't care what your background is. We don't care what your interests are, as long as you can uphold your end of the contract, which means you've got the money. Okay, and the more money you have, in principle, the freer you are. Because the more contracts you can enter into, the more deals you can cut, the more options you have. And so this is where money becomes quite an important thing as a measure of freedom. Because if you don't have a lot of money, your options are limited, and you're forced to work within a narrow range. Okay, and this is Gesellschaft, and Gesellschaft is the term that gets used in German to talk about associations. Now, when we say the word association, you should understand this word in a relatively superficial way. In other words, like a network, right? Where people are, as it were, joined together for a specific reason, for a limited amount of time, and then the nodes split apart and hook up with other things, right? So an association is something that has a kind of temporary efficacy. So you and I engage in a contract. Once the contract is done and we both get what we bargained for, then the contract's ended and we go on and do something else. We're not stuck with each other for the rest of our lives, except in marriage, okay? Which is a contract that does have this kind of lifelong thing attached to it. But otherwise, you know, contracts normally have a natural termination point. That's the whole point. That's part of the freedom of the contract. And also, contracts can be broken if one side doesn't live up to it. So the point is, even though contracts are the basis for modern social relations, they're actually quite fragile things in a way. They can break apart pretty easily, and they have a natural ending. They don't last forever, except marriage. Right? At least in the old days. But I do think that's kind of an important point, right? Because if you go back to the period when natural law was really dominant in the Middle Ages, it was actually very hard if you're someone who wasn't born into the right family. In other words, if you were born as a serf, if you weren't born as a noble, right? It was actually very hard for you to ever change your position in life. All right, and to break away from this kind of predictable routine of things. So one of the ways you could do it, though, and this is what one of the first moments of the Gesellschaft coming into play, was when you went off to war. Okay, and so this is kind of an interesting. You guys know about this, the Crusades, right? In the Middle Ages. Right, the Pope declares this war against the Muslims and to go into the Holy Land and to liberate the Holy Land from the Muslim threat, blah, blah, blah. And so you had this crusades going on. And there were several of these things that went on for a couple of centuries. And they involved thousands and thousands of Christians, right, moving across Europe to the Holy Land. And these Christians were people from many different walks of life. Okay, this is the point, right? In fact, the idea was, because it was this crusade, you really wanted the whole Christendom involved. So you wanted the rich, the poor, you wanted everyone moving out there. And the thing, though, was that the kinds of social arrangements that you would have to undergo in order to fight this crusade, which, you know, like I say, some people spent their whole lives pretty much involved in it. Right, is that you need special social arrangements because you're talking about an extreme circumstance, a volatile circumstance, one which is no longer tied to people's particular origins, but is basically a warfare situation, right? One where you're moving into new terrain, things are unpredictable, yet nevertheless, people have to be able to work with each other. Right? The people from all the different walks of life who would otherwise live relatively segregated existences in the context of warfare have to be working together. So you need a certain kind of legal arrangement to actually allow the rich and the poor and so forth to interact more freely than they normally would in order to have a very kind of sharp, flexible military force. Okay? So it was in the context of this military operation, basically, that we start to get this more Gesellschaft notion of law developing, where people, for temporary periods, are able to suspend their class differences and actually work together and assist each other and all the rest of it, right? It gave a kind of temporary equality, you might say, because all of these people were fixated on a common goal, which was to overturn Islam, basically. Liberate Jerusalem, this kind of thing. Okay? And so this was happening in the Middle Ages. Another moment in the development of Gesellschaft, which was very important, was in the early modern period when you start to get several of the European countries. I mean, you know, one thinks here about Spain and Portugal and Italy. Then later Britain and the Netherlands, wanting to send ships overseas, right, for purposes of, well, basically wealth creation, let's put it that way, right, where they would go into Asia or Africa or the Americas, and they would see what they could get out of it and bring it back for these countries. Okay, on these ships that would travel for long distances, in order to actually bankroll these operations, which were always very risky operations, it was important that you had a kind of broad range of people involved in the ship would be able to work together in many tasks, because the ship would essentially constitute a little mini society for several months at a time, right? You can easily imagine that. And so it became important when you started getting all of these exploratory missions going on that, again, you had to suspend somewhat the kinds of rules that, you know, on shore, right, would segregate people too much. Okay? So these kinds of arrangements, which were largely economic arrangements to bring wealth back from other parts of the world, actually also tended to democratize the relationship of the people who were involved in those enterprises. But again, this was temporary, right? Once the ships came back, right, then people went back to their default positions in wherever they lived, okay? So the modern period is really quite useful, quite unique, rather, in that it basically pushes forward this idea of democratized human relations across the board, not just for temporary periods when one's fighting in a war or one's engaged in some overseas exploration, but rather as the normal default setting for the way in which society is organized, which means that you start to introduce an enormous amount of dynamism into the society. Well, now, what I mean by the dynamism is the fact, the potential for people to change their own status through the law. And this is where the issue of being able to enter into contracts becomes important. Now, of course, when you start having this kind of notion of the law, where people are able to change their standing through contracts, right, there is all kind of possibilities, and not only possibilities, but actualities, of exploitation, right? Because, and this is something that, in a sense, the law had to very quickly catch up on. See, one of the things about natural law theory, and I think I may have mentioned this last week, was that natural law theory and the way it governed its mode of legal enforcement, generally speaking, involved a principle of subsidiarity, which is to say that the way the laws were enforced really was devolved to the local level, and that the local level, you typically were relying on relations of trust, right, that were built up over several generations, where there's a lot of authority given, let's say, to the local, you know, parish priest, right, who is somebody who you can go to if you have a problem or you need to have a dispute resolved, right? And so, you know, if you look at even in this country and you look at the medieval churches of this country, you will see, right, that there will be records that were kept by the parish priests, which basically are almost like legal records in terms of telling about all the various things that he had to get himself involved in terms of counseling people, resolving disputes, marrying people, burying people, all these kinds of things, right? All these legal things were in the priest. And this is subsidiary, right? It gets devolved to that level, and there is no sense of, the parish priest may in fact be doing this for his entire life, and nobody's ever looking over his shoulder. And everybody trusts him, and as long as everybody trusts him, everything's cool, okay? And so it's only when things start to get out of control, where people start to believe crazy things and they overturn the church and, you know, all these things about heretics and so forth, that then the Pope will start to send out his governor generals to the provinces to find out what the hell's going on. But otherwise, things are run very much locally. That's kind of how it was in the Middle Ages. So there was a sense in which there was a normal that was pretty much observed, and the natural law theory fitted very well with the kind of normal way of life where people trust each other, etc. Now, when you get into the modern period, this disappears. Okay? This disappears. People are moving around from place to place. They're changing their identity. All that they've got, as it were, guaranteeing things is a piece of paper that has a contract on it. Right? And then the question is, who's enforcing the contract?
right? There's lots of room for exploitation. What happens if you don't live up to your side of the contract? What do I do? Where do I go? Okay? So one of the things that you start to see happening immediately in the modern era, as soon as we move to this more procedural notion of the law, is you get the rise of lawyers. Right? Lawyers. And I mean the lawyers we are used to today, the ones that defend individual people. I don't mean the lawyers who work for the church, or the, you know, because there is, of course, this great long history of the legal profession, which is basically an adjunct to diplomacy, right? Laws who work, you know, lawyers who work for the church, lawyers who work for the king, right? Francis Bacon, for example, you may have heard of him. He was a lawyer to King James I, right? There's, of course, a long history of those kinds of lawyers, but what you don't have until you get into the modern period are the lawyers who defend individuals in specific cases. Okay? And you might wonder, well, why do we need these guys? Well, we need these guys because of all of the opportunities for exploitation that all of this freedom that gets opened up allows. Right? Who is enforcing the law when, as it were, the various social arrangements that people are making are ultimately contractual, which is to say they're based on the two parties who might have very little in common with each other, nevertheless trusting that each will uphold his end of the bargain. Who enforces this? Right? Especially when we're talking about a society of strangers. That is to say, people you don't know who the other person is. You just know they have something you want and you have something they want. And that's the primary ground for the social interaction. Who enforces the law? And what happens if one side doesn't uphold the law? Okay? I mean, what do? Kill them? What do? You let them get away with it? See, I mean, this is where you start to need lawyers. And not only do you need lawyers, you need judges. And not only do you need judges, you need police. Okay? And so all of these institutions that we take for granted, you know, as part of what it means to have the law in society, right, are things that basically get invented starting in the, you know, 17th, 18th century, and are pretty much in place by the middle of the 19th century. Okay? And they are all products of the fact that in the modern period, because we're dealing with abstract individuals engaged in contracts with each other, there is no natural mode of law enforcement. Right? There's nothing you can fall back on as trust or common feeling or anything like that. And this is why you start to get a lot of legal theorists in the modern period, including Weber, for example. Weber is very clear on this point. You know, so if you ask Weber, you know, what is the source of, you know, what enforces the law at the end of the day? What's the bottom line? It's power. It's force. It is, you know, the threat of force. Right? In other words, the reason why I uphold my contract is I'm afraid I'm going to get sued. Okay? And so the normative authority of the law, and this starts to get us into thinking about what we're doing next week, because next week is about the normativity of the law. Where does that come from? Right? In the modern period, increasingly you get the thinkers about the law falling back on this notion of the threat of force. Right? Because there is no common feeling, there's no longer a kind of common culture, there is no longer a kind of religious belief, or anything of that sort that you can rely on, which was the thing that kept natural law sort of working, even though nobody was watching over the shoulder of the parish priest. Okay? In the modern period, once all that's gone, then you have to start coming up with notions of force and power to make sure the laws are operative. Okay? And so this is where you start to get the kind of, the sort of trade-off issue that I was mentioning earlier, right? That one of the things that you've traded off by moving into this modern notion of procedural law, where individuals are these free, abstract, you know, beings, these agents who are able to engage in contracts with each other, is you lose a certain sense, a certain default sense of security, right? You have to basically make up your social arrangements as you go along. Right? And what you have in the background, and why you keep those social arrangements? Well, because you've got the force of law behind it. Namely, someone will come down heavy on you if you don't uphold your contracts. Okay, and it's that threat of sanction, right, that ends up then becoming incredibly important. And you see, we can all, you know, this is where somebody like Thomas Hobbes is such an important figure in the history of legal thinking, because he really marks the point, the transition point, where the whole facade, the whole image of God and a kind of religious worldview really drops, and what you've got instead is the sheer absolute power of God, but without all the nice cultural bits, right? You've got the absolute power, which upholds the law. That remains of God, you might say, because both natural law theory and modern law has this idea of the absolute power of the sovereign is there, okay? But in modern law, it is a secular sovereign. It is the state who has the power. And then the state's power is enforced through all of these agencies of the law, which we've just been talking about, the lawyers, the judges, the police, right? They enforce the power, and that's what keeps all the contracts that you make working, okay? Now see, some of the sociologists, when they ponder this transition, because remember, this transition that we're talking about really only gets finalized, you might say, in the early to mid-19th century. So for a lot of these sociologists like Weber and Durkheim and so forth, they're thinking about a period that is maybe the time of their grandparents, right? When there was still a kind of strong natural law sensibility going on. So there, it's within a kind of living memory, you might say, for them. What is the before and after? Right? See, we live with the modern law for so many generations now that we take it for granted. And so we take the whole idea that, you know, it's the threat of sanctions that keeps the law working. All of these ideas are fairly, these modern ideas, people take this for granted. They kind of, well, I don't know if they're comfortable with it, but they accept it. Yet this is an idea that actually had to be manufactured. And so the sociologists are sort of weighing what's been gained and what's been lost in the process, okay? And so next week we are going to move more directly into this idea of the normativity of the law, that is to say, what gives the law force, okay? But before we go, are there any questions about what I've said? Questions about any of this? We've got a couple of minutes. Come on, guys. I know you're all just overwhelmed, but. You sure? Okay, well, look. Next week, we're going to continue on this issue of the normativity of the law, right? What gives the law its power, its force? But in any case, we'll continue with this in the seminars.